Welcome to episode 100, Mike, of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Of course, folks, you can find us anywhere you listen to your podcast. We ask that you subscribe, you leave us a rating, you give us your review, tell your friends about us, tell your colleagues. That's how you're going to help us grow this podcast that Mike and I love doing so much. Joined as always by Mr. Mike Oitzman, editor of the Mobile Robot Guide. Mike, 100 episodes, man. Congrats.
Thanks. Yeah. Congratulations to you, Steve. It's quite a milestone and one of many, I hope, as we continue forward. And it's fun to just put this stake in the ground. And you know, in prepping for this episode, it was fun to go back and sort of scroll through all the various episodes that we pulled together and look at, you know, the list of folks that we've actually talked to. It's been quite a journey, and I'm looking forward to the future as we continue to have conversations and explore and talk about all things robotics.
Yeah, here's to the next 100, right? So it took us, you know, we started this before you joined us, of course. I think the first episode you wrote this down was June 3rd of 2020. So yep. It was during the height of the pandemic, really. So 2.5 years ago, we started this thing. So it's been so much fun. It's been very educational for me every step of the way. We'll get into some of the stats here in a second. I do want to just plug the interview that's on the show today. Tremendous interview that you did, Mike, with Nick Radford. He's the founder and CEO of Nauticus Robotics. He also, in the past, he was the chief engineer for NASA's humanoid space robot, the Robonaut 2. So what he's doing now at Nauticus is building robots for underwater exploration and different underwater tasks, you know, remote underwater vehicles with these crazy sophisticated robot arms. So a really unique look, Mike, at a market and an application that we haven't discussed all that much with Nauticus, but also a very interesting background from Nick with his work on space robotics.
Yeah, definitely. This was a great, great conversation, a fun conversation. And, you know, they often say that this is one of the final frontiers, certainly terrestrially, but I think it's true. And I hope by the end of the conversation, you all have that same sort of takeaway that, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that are happening here. A lot of interesting robotics problems to solve, automation problems to solve as well. And we'll talk about how Nauticus is approaching that.
So stay tuned for that coming up here in a little bit, but we do have to, Mike, reminisce about our first 100 episodes here a little bit. I think you joined, I looked it up earlier today, it was episode 39 that you joined us on, which was that Austin Dynamics, I think was who we had on that episode, perhaps. Kevin Blankenspor might've been that episode.
Yeah.
Talking about the new stretch robot. But you dug up some pretty cool stats about the first 100 episodes.
Yeah, so looking back through the place here, and again, thanks to everybody in the audience who's listened, who listens every week, who, again, you say the same thing, Steve. Every time we go out to an event and talk to folks who are listening, I love having those conversations. So thanks. We have had 130,000 plays, listens, since the inception. So, and that's an average of about 1,400 listens per episode. So thanks to our 1,000-plus listeners out there.
Joe Rogan better watch out. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, we're on a terror here.
Yeah.
Right? And so and I also went and found that, you know, the top three tracks that have been listened to most often, and if you haven't heard these, definitely worth listening to. Episode 67, we talked to Jan Becker, CEO and co-founder of Apex. That was also on that show was Joe Speed, who at the time was the VP of a product and chief evangelist at Apex. And again, the conversation was around the application of Apex to the India Autonomous Challenge, which again, looking forward in a month, Steve, yep. I'll be heading to CES to see all those vehicles run. So looking forward to that. The second most listened to episode was probably one of my favorite conversations, which was with Rashed Haque, VP of Robotics for Cruise. That was episode 71. So,
why did you like that episode, though? I know what you're going to get at. It wasn't even about the robo-taxi discussion, right? It was about his AI-generated photography. Is that what it was?
That's exactly right. As a photographer, I was just incredibly amazed that he has, and as a machine learning scientist, has used his own photography to design his own models trained on his own imagery, and then he can ask that model to actually create new images based on his imagery. So unlike Midjourney, which has millions of images to look at, he trained it just on his imagery. We talk a bit about that, and that was one of my fascinating takeaways from that one. And then the third most popular track, probably for obvious reasons, was Brian Gerke from Open Robotics. We have a huge Open Robotics community that we know listens. That was episode 84. So that was number three all time.
Yeah, that's awesome. You also dug up the top countries that listen to the show. US, number one, of course. Canada, Germany following suit. It's good that we don't have India up there or some country that is often, internet bots or something, right? So it's legitimate places with great robotics industries. New York, San Fran, Pittsburgh are the top cities. So San Fran and Pittsburgh, two of the top robotics clusters in the world. I'm from Boston. I got to get my Boston love a little bit better represented here in the listeners. So I got some work to do.
You're right. Yeah. But yeah, so it's fun I'm a data junkie, so it's fun to sort of follow statistics. So again, thanks to everybody who's made this possible and continues to listen every week. And then, Steve, so tell me, looking back beyond just those couple three that we just talked about, who've been some of your favorite guests over the years?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I don't want to, it has played a valuable role in growing this podcast, right? And certainly some interviews go better than others. Some of that could be our fault, right? Some of it's not our fault, but some of them certainly go better than others. And I think, when we started this, one of the things that we were trying to do was make it timely. Are there things that are happening in the world, or the robotics industry more specifically, that we can somehow bring into a real-time, timely, educated conversation? Unfortunately, with robotics, things often get blown out of proportion in the mainstream media. That's not who we are. And we have access to some of the folks who are building these technologies and get really educated, realistic views on what is going on. So that's what we've tried to do. I think we've done that a lot, Mike. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but I think it's worked out pretty well. So, some of the ones that stick out to me, I'm a big self-driving car guy. I love robo-taxis and the challenges that are going on in that space right now. I go back to the interview that we had with JJ Ricks. I think probably the most prolific rider of Waymo robo-taxis ever outside of someone who's a Waymo employee. So he's done hundreds of rides down in the Phoenix area, I believe. And there was a story that happened a while ago now where one of the Waymo robo-taxis got confused by a lane that was shut down due to some traffic cones. The car got confused multiple times. There was a human chase vehicle. A remote operator that was coming to get the vehicle, gets out of the car to try to step into the Waymo robo-taxi. The robo-taxi then drives away. So it was this whole confusing mess that happened. He actually documented the whole thing as he did a number of rides. And this probably happens often still with Waymo and Cruise and some of the other major robo-taxi players, but that was a major story at the time, right? He was a rider who was legally allowed to document his ride. So Waymo was entrusting him and they trusted their vehicles enough to let him ride. And he just happened to be there at the right time, I guess, right? To catch something like this on camera. And what that does is this really gives not only us, but the readers in our audience access to more realistic information as to what's going on. Yes, these robo-taxis have made tremendous progress, but here's an example of an incident that, if this continues to happen frequently enough, is going to limit these cars from being able to scale to other places and environments, right? So that's what we've tried to do is make things timely. So something like that, I go back to the conversation that we had with the Jenga robot creator. I think we found this out in almost real time. I think it was before we hit record. This was, if you folks remember, around the chess playing incident where there was a chess tournament in Russia, maybe, Mike. And it had pinched, the robot arm had pinched, or the gripper had pinched and trapped a young kid's hand on the chessboard in between the robot and the chessboard. And so we were trying to find someone to come on and talk about what had happened. And we got this gentleman from the University of Michigan, and unbeknownst to us, he actually created a Jenga robot during his days at MIT. So he actually had a pretty great understanding of some of the safety aspects that should be considered in a system like this. That's for fun and is playing a game. So that was very timely. He was all over mainstream media. He was on CNN. I think that's how we found him. And again, he brings a realistic, educated point of view to that discussion. So those are the ones that always kind of stick out to me, is these things that are more real time, more current event. Again, we've had many other ones. I know one of your favorite ones was Samantha Johnson from Tatum Robotics just a couple of weeks ago, who, you know, folks who are creating tremendous technologies that are going to change people's lives when they eventually make it to the commercial market. But so there's a wide variety of folks that stick out to me. What about you?
Yeah, and we, you know, Samantha was just a joy to interview. She was passionate, and I think I love talking to all of these individuals who are passionate about what they're doing. And I think those are some of the best interviews. We talked about the conversation with John Hirschtick, founder of Onshape, and he is just a great speaker. Has a podcast of his own. And that was a fun conversation to do, just because he was just such a great speaker, right? So we didn't have to work hard on that conversation with John.
No, I think I actually shut my mic off during that. But and another aspect of it is some of the personal stories that these people bring to the table. And he has an incredible personal story, right? Yep. With his SolidWorks, finding that company and scaling and selling that company, his days on the MIT poker team, and
yeah, right,
how that sort of helped shape some of his entrepreneurial behaviors and beliefs. There was a conversation that I had before you joined was with two folks from a company called TerraDepth. They're building autonomous underwater machines. They wanted, at the time, they said they wanted to create the Google Earth of the ocean. So build these underwater robots to go map the ocean and the ocean floor, or however far down they can get. And I haven't checked in on them in a while, so I'm not sure what they're up to at this point in time. But the two of the founders of that company were ex-Marines. And they had spent, or maybe Navy, I forget. But just they talked a lot about how their time serving created this path for them, they came up with this idea while they were serving. And it's just sometimes you come across these incredible stories that also play a big role in how well the interview goes.
And as much as we love technology in here, we want to celebrate the technology. It's also fun, of course, to talk about the stories about how the companies came to be, how they've evolved, how they're innovating, not only inside of the technology and the robots and everything that makes that happen, but also how they're innovating with their business models and the types of markets and applications that they're building.
Yeah. So one of the things that we're going to do when this podcast comes out, you guys listening will have we're going to create a playlist for you of our favorite episodes from the first 100 shows that we've done. You know, so it'll include some of the folks that we just talked about there. You know, some of the other ones, Mike, that stand out to me, Mike Dooley from Labrador Systems. They're creating the autonomous mobile robot to help elderly people or people who have mobility issues live independently more for a little bit longer. That was a very interesting conversation. He's a great speaker. He has great experience in robotics. He was part of I can't think of the robot cleaning company that Paolo Perginian created years ago that iRobot acquired. So he's had tremendous robotics experience. He was on the Lego Mindstorms team years ago. Had a great conversation with James DeSmet. He's the president and CEO of a company called CRG Automation. He took me through his whole system that they've designed to decommission chemical weapons down at a facility, I believe, in Kentucky. That's not what this company does. They're a palletizing company, I believe, or a packaging company.
And yep, right.
So he kind of looked at the process of decommissioning chemical weapons with robots as the same sort of packaging, palletizing application that his company has expertise in. And they were just able to, again, the items that they're packaging in this case just happened to be chemical weapons. So, I mean, that was an interesting conversation. you know, Ken Goldberg's great. Kevin Blankenspor from Boston Dynamics is great. I think the interview that I've probably gotten the most feedback on was my conversation with Greg Smith from Teradyne. Yeah. And, you know, just talking about Teradyne's view on the robotics landscape and how they evaluate companies that they might want to acquire. Of course, they own Energid and AutoGuide and Mobile Industrial Robots and Universal Robots. I think that's the one that I've actually gotten the most feedback on, positive feedback on. And I think that's, to me, the real value in us doing this podcast. Again, we launched it during the pandemic. We have to keep conversations going. Our in-person events went away for 2 years or whatever, but we're going to continue to do this, of course, because, you know, I don't think I knew Greg much or at all until that point in time. And of course, we write about the companies that he's overseeing, but he came on the podcast. We had a great discussion. You know, you proved to him in a way that you know what you're talking about, right? You're educated on the space and you kind of build that mutual respect for one another. And it's opened up doors for us, right? So he promoted the Robotics Summit and Expo this past May in Boston. You know, Kevin Blankenspor also keynoted the show. So I think that's, to me, something I don't think I realized how important it would be for this podcast is just opening the doors to people and building relationships with people and, you know, getting ourselves out there. And to your point earlier, you never know who's going to listen to this. And that's really why we should do it is you meet people at these shows and they come up to you and I all the time and then just recognize us from our voices, which is crazy to think about, right? But it's the amount of people who have said to us, you know, thank you for doing this. You know, it's just a great way to keep updated on what's going on in the robotics industry, or you're really educating me on what's going on in robotics. It's just pretty cool to hear. And so it's been a lot of fun for the first 100 shows. It's been a lot of work, of course, but I think there is a lot of room for improvement, Mike. So I don't know if you want to talk about some ideas there. Like what do you think, if you just take a step back, like what do you think we can do better or differently?
Well, I think, yeah, you made one point, which is as we get more credibility here for understanding the market, we get a chance to get access to some more high profile guests on the show. So I think that's going to continue to be a feature as well. You know, and we also talk about doing the show on a timely basis, on a weekly basis, trying to get it out with a cadence that keeps you up to speed. We want this to continue to be, you know, the go-to place for what's going on in robotics this week, this today type of thing. And of course, give you our unabashed opinions about what we think that represents. So I hope you guys find that relevant. And of course, as we emerge from the pandemic, now we get a chance to travel, get a chance to visit and spend more time in the field, bring you more, you know, content from the field, from events. For example, I'm going to be at the upcoming India Autonomous Challenge at CES. I'm going to bring you some live content there and actually give you a chance to talk to folks as it's happening and give you a chance to, you know, understand exactly how that type of event falls out. So those are the type of things we want to continue to bring in. And if you have other ideas, things you want us to do, things you think we could do better, we want to hear from you, good, bad, or otherwise. Send us a message, drop us a voicemail. Again, we'd love to feature you if you have feedback there, or even, you know, pending content for us, give us a shout.
One of the things that we've often talked about is this, I don't even know if this is the right word, but topical episodes. So dedicating an entire episode to really diving into one topic, mm-hmm. right? And getting multiple people on. And if you listen to NPR podcasts, you know what we're talking about. It's really, you're creating an audio story around one issue, right? That would be something that I think super fun to do, super informative and educational. It's just super time intensive, right?
Yeah, right.
Intensive. One of them that comes to mind, we might be dropping a second episode of the podcast Thursday or Friday that dives into what just happened in San Francisco, where San Francisco they voted and they're now allowing their police department to use robots with deadly force, right? That's I don't think any other police department in the country has the okay to do that. It's a pretty important issue that we should talk about. And, you know, we have one gentleman who's going to come on to the podcast tomorrow morning. Paul Shari. He was involved in developing policy for the U.S. military and the Department of Defense around using similar systems, right? Autonomous systems, autonomous weapons, emerging weapons technology. So he's very well versed in the space, and we're talking to him. But how can we get others involved to talk about that same issue and produce one really well done episode around that one topic? That's been something that you and I have always talked about. I don't know if it's ever going to happen because we're a small crew, but even other topics, you know, the development of autonomous vehicles, or you're a big robots as a service guy, you know, really diving into these episodes. I think that would be something people would like.
Yep.
I'm just not sure if at this point in time, you know, we're going to be able to pull it off, but I know that's something that I would really love to do. So we'll try to explore that a little bit as well, but we should just dive into that story, Mike.
Yeah. Again,
thank you to everybody for tuning in to this show. Really appreciate it. And we're not going anywhere. So we're here's to one. Let's see if we can do another 100 in less than 2.5 years. Right.
We should
be able to do that. So thanks to Mike. Thanks to everybody behind the scenes who's made this possible. Really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. But major story last night, Mike, out in San Francisco, where again the board of supervisors voted to allow the San Francisco Police Department to use remote controlled and potentially lethal robots in emergency situations. The board voted 8-3 in favor of giving police the option to deploy these ground-based robots as a last resort in emergency situations. Just opening thoughts from you.
Well, we've been bouncing around several related topics in the last month or so around this idea, and I think that it's interesting that it's coming to a head here in this idea, from the San Francisco Police Department. And I think it's one of those things that touches an emotional nerve for a lot of folks, which is fine. Everybody's got their thoughts and ideas about it. But and certainly we ran the story back on October 6th, you know, the pledge from the industry leaders of Agility, Antibotics, Boston Dynamics, and others that don't want to weaponize their platforms. And I think that's an interesting stake to put into the ground as well. But, you know, at the same time, it begs the question, what's a robot, right? And, yeah. You know, in these situations, and I guess where I'm going with that is the idea that, just because a robot might be cute and have four legs and dances around, that's one concept of a robot. But, you know, can you call a cruise missile a robot? I don't know. But that's open for debate. So, you know, a lot of folks have tried to say, you know, we don't want to weaponize robots. Well, we've got a lot of autonomous weapons already in the military. And, the question becomes, you know, when are those applicable in other places? So I think it's a good question to debate. And certainly as robotics evolves, as it matures, we're going to continue to have these types of conversations and these types of situations come up around the world. And so this is just happens to be the first one is to pop its head up that's, you know, worthy of consideration.
I don't know how this conversation is going to go tomorrow with Paul Shari, right? This is a very complex issue. We try to avoid a lot of the issues involved with this, with police brutality and police mistreating certain people, which has been well documented. We're not,
right.
I don't want to get into that, you know, but I don't know if you can, I'm not sure it's avoidable in a situation like this. There's some people who on the board of supervisors who voted against this proposal, who brought up some of those other issues I'm alluding to as to why they're not voting in favor of this proposal. I want to try to avoid that, but I think it's very important to try to like set the stage for what it is that they're trying to do, when it is that they would use one of these ground-based remote controlled, is it a robot, right?
Yep.
And it's in, and I think that's where some people might have some issue with this. It's like, what constitutes a last resort effort? You know, how are we ensuring that some of these other de-escalation tactics have been thoroughly attempted? Who is in charge? Who gives the go-ahead to use this deadly, you know, lethal force via robot command? And these are not autonomous robots. I think that's a very common mistake that the general public thinks about. All that I saw on Twitter last night was GIF after GIF after GIF of RoboCop, right? That's not what this is. Yep. I think a lot of folks have also pointed to, and we included that in our story from Brianna this morning, a situation that took place in Dallas. I believe it was 2016, where there was a sniper, a random person who was literally sniping and killing police officers in Dallas, killed five of them, just picking them off with a sniper rifle. And the police couldn't catch them. It's a nightmare situation. It's a horrific situation. This person was barricaded somewhere, or they had him trapped somewhere. And rather than sending in other human police officers who potentially would lose their life, they had a ground-based remote-controlled robot that they literally Mickey'd a bomb onto, drove it to where this person was, and blew that person up and ended the situation. And, you know, my question to people is, like, you would rather send in other human officers into that deadly situation rather than using this tool? We often hear robots are tools to do something, right? This is a very dangerous situation for a person, way more dangerous than a lot of other applications that robots are used for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it just always comes back to, like, we want robots to be these nice, you know, friendly looking things. And I don't know, I just can't imagine a situation where it's like, I have this tool at my disposal to ensure or try to reduce the chances that we lose another police officer, but I don't want to send it in because it's a robot. Like, I don't understand the connection to literally, like, the word robot and why people are so frightened by this. This is not a RoboCop situation. It's not going to turn into a RoboCop situation. You know, if these things are misused, they're going to be shut down. There's other, you know, somebody on social media posted, like, well, you know, cops, there's a lot of ways that cops, you know, kill people, right? Yes, they use their guns. Yes, they've been misused. What about a car? You know, there's situations where cops kill people with their car. There's so many angles to this. This is just one more way that the cops have at their disposal to end a horrific situation that poses not only grave danger to themselves, but also to the general public. These robots are not going to be used for petty criminals. This is the worst of the worst, right? This is a Dallas sniper who's killed five police officers, and they don't want any more of their cops to die. We're going to send the robot in. I don't understand the problem with that.
Well, I would hope that out of this, we can talk through it. The policies and the escalation procedures and the authorization type of protocols that have to happen to lead to this situation so that it's done outside of the heat of the moment. And you know, we can have a debate at a time when there's not an emergency situation at play. And then, you know, that's the best way for policing to operate is to, you know, have thought through those situations and then, you know, do the appropriate training. And of course, acquire the appropriate tools to make it possible.
So. Yeah, and they talked a lot about that in the board meeting last night about, hey, we've debated this a number of times. I think they said six or seven times we've debated this. You know, some of them were not sure that debating it more at this point in time would be beneficial, but move forward past it with the understanding that we're going to go back and we do have to tighten up some of that language. How do we ensure that, you know, again, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, how do we ensure that, you know, everybody involved in this situation from the police department's perspective, you know, has thoroughly attempted some of these alternative de-escalation tactics and that this situation does warrant the potential lethal force of a robot? You know, are there situations where the robot can be sent in and there's some way to incapacitate or knock out or, you know, daze this person without ending their life? You know, that's also on the table as well. You know, but again, oftentimes when those situations are at that point, there's often not a time to turn back, right? So it's, you know, I don't know. I think that is, to me, the issue that should be debated is the language. You know, how do we ensure this is being used properly? But if you just take a step back and say, you know, fundamentally, there's a tool that's going to prevent another police officer from recklessly losing their lives when they're trying to keep civilians safe, or they're just being specifically targeted by someone, a la the Dallas incident in 2016. I don't know. I just don't have a problem with that. But I guess we'll have to see what happens. Obviously, we'll keep you covered. Again, we're having a conversation tomorrow morning with Paul Shari. We'll see how it goes. He was involved with drafting policy for the Department of Defense and the military around different types of autonomous systems, different types of emerging weapons technologies. So again, I know it's a little bit different, right? He's developing, or he was drafting policies for the military, which is different, obviously, than a local police department. But I think he has some pretty solid experience with how to properly develop these legislations and these rules and these policies. So hopefully he'll shed some light into what's going on in this San Francisco situation. And we'll keep you folks covered with our network of websites. But Mike, moving on here to a new standard from ASTM about defining some different objects that could be encountered by AMRs and AGVs.
Yeah, on a more pedestrian front.
Time to change gears here.
Yeah, shifting gears a bit. So I just wanted to make note here, a new standard from ASTM, F3588-22, pretty simple standard, straightforward, and it was released on November 9th. And really the idea here is just, this is more of a terminology standard to define, you know, the list of items that might be encountered by an autonomous unmanned robot. I don't know if armed gunman's on that list, Steve, but typical things that they might encounter in their working environment: chairs, tables, forklifts, that type of thing, that would be there. And really, I think where this is applicable is going to be useful for standardizing, you know, tagging image data, perception information across AI models. So it'll be useful to say, what's a chair? And for classifying things, right? So as a mobile robot encounters something that it sees, how does a chair behave differently from a fork truck or a pallet? What kind of behaviors do those things have? And how do you model, and how do you perceive them, and how do you interact with them? So look, I try to keep track of all the applicable standards for mobile robots. There's a subpage on the mobile robot guide where you can go find that, and this will be added up there in the next day or two to continue to keep you guys up to date and give you a single source to go find, you know, all the standards that are important for mobile robot development.
Aaron Prather, keeping you busy, Mike.
Yeah, exactly.
Director of the standards over there at ASTM. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. And there's also some other standards coming down the pike that we'll obviously share as well. Sticking with mobile robotics news, Mike, our friends at Locus Robotics raised another $117 million for their AMRs. They've now raised, I think it's just over $420 million over seven rounds since 2016. I've seen some numbers where they're valued at more than $2 billion now.
Yeah.
So congrats to Rick and Karen and the whole crew over there. But just some thoughts on Locus and you know, really seems to be they're setting the standard for how you want to build an AMR company.
Yeah, look, I think Locus Robotics, I like to call them the poster child for a successful RAS-based business, and they continue to prove that they know how to generate value out of that business model. And I think a big chunk of that, almost $500 million, you got to remember, is going into the manufacturing their fleet of robots. So for anybody in the audience that's thinking about or in the process of developing a RAS-based business, I think this is a good, you need to look at Locus, look at the path that they've been on, right? Seven rounds over since 2016. It is sort of a long runway. Expect to continue to you know, generate the funding that it's going to take to build your fleet of robots. Because again, Locus doesn't sell its robots. You can only hire them in a RAS-based subscription model. So Locus continues to grow, as they continue to sell and find new customers, they need to build and deploy more robots to continue to fulfill those contracts. And that's exactly how this works. So
yeah, unpack that a little more. You know, basically they own the robots still, right? Locus.
Yeah, that's right. They own the robots. They're of course they're generating revenue from those assets that they own. That's the crux of a RaaS-based business. And so again, as they get more successful, they have to build more robots to deploy them to continue to fulfill the contractual obligations. And so that's why they need more money. This is a good thing. The more money they need to raise means the more success that they're doing and the more money that they're basically printing every day with that fleet of robots. So I think it's just a great, they're going to be talking about this, you know, in business school when you're getting your MBAs, you know, this is how you do a service-based business for robots.
It's crazy. Series F funding round. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever heard that in certainly the robotics space. I don't think I have. I would be interested in following up with them. Maybe we'll do that sometime soon here, because when they raised, I think there was it last year, Mike, $150 million Series E round.
Yeah.
Or was it D at that time? I can't remember. But I remember we had a conversation with Rick Falk, and you know the going public was being thrown around at that time. Right. It's another the next maybe avenue for them to continue to raise funding was becoming a publicly traded company. Now, a lot's happened since then. The economy is not exactly doing great, if people haven't been paying attention to that. So is now the right time for them to go become a public company? Maybe that I'm not sure, but I would love to catch up with them to learn more about sort of their future plans for this. Because you're right, they're going to have to continue to raise money as they continue to grow. And just to give you guys a little insight to how much they have grown, you know, they're claiming Locus that they have more than 90 customers around the world. I think it was around 230 sites are under contract around the world. Some of those sites have as many as 500 Locus bots operating around the warehouses. And this is the incredible thing to me that really shows how quickly this company is growing. In September 2022, we covered they reached their 1 billionth pick.
Yeah, right?
It was a pretty big milestone for them. They're claiming it's the first AMR company to surpass a billion picks. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but they told us at the time it took them 1,542 days to pick its first 100 million units. Now, for their next 100 million units, or the last 100 million picks, excuse me, it took them just 40 days.
Yeah, it's going to be a geometric from this point forward.
Right, so 1,500 plus days for its first 100 million units, 40 days for its last 100 million units. And again, that was back in September, so they might have already picked. They probably have another 100 million units, 100 million picks since then. So yeah, they're really just kind of going gangbusters here. So congrats to the folks over at Locus Robotics. Last story here, Mike, before we get to our interview with Nick Radford. I know you wanted to mention this swarming system from MIT of assembling robots that you thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, it's swarming robots, a funny word that we put out there about types of robots, but these MIT researchers posted these MIT researchers posted a video of their swarm of robots, and basically these robots self-assemble and they're building structures and they're trying to figure out algorithmically, you know, how to control the robots to build structures. And one of the interesting things that was in the story, and you can go look at the research, is that they didn't tell the robots that they could actually build more robots to help them achieve the goal. And that was one of the outcomes that the algorithm attempted to do, was to build more robots. And, you know, that was one of those fascinating side effects. And that's creating a whole new branch of you know, research goals for the next iteration of this. Is, you know, to figure out how to define the goal in a way that the system can reach that goal. And I think is this going to have applications in manufacturing or warehousing? Not sure, but certainly for space robotics in the future, that's one practical application. So it's a little bit out there.
Yeah.
But if you're a robot geek, it's a fun video to watch, and you know, put a smile on your face.
Yeah, we need that after last night's crazy vote in San Francisco, right? So we have the video and the story up on the Robot Report. If you guys haven't seen it already, you can go check it out. And again, folks, we have you covered with all the latest happenings in the global robotics industry with our network of websites. You can check us out at the Robot Report, Mobile Robot Guide, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends.
All right, well, we're here this morning with the founder and CEO of Nauticus Robotics. I've got Nick Radford here with us. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks for having me. It's kind of a fun time, Mike. I can feel it already.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, this is an interesting market space, and your robot that we're going to talk about here, I think, is incredibly interesting. But before we get to that, why don't you tell us a little bit about the origin for Nauticus and a little bit about your background? Because I think you've got an interesting background as well. And I want to make sure everyone understands where you're coming from.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, so the origin story is obviously it started with some roots at NASA. We're pretty public about that. Mm-hmm. Because it's so central to, you know, our thinking and what we think we can really change about the ocean industry. But the origin group of the company, you know, we had about 20 or so early joiners that came out of the NASA world. All of them had really no background in the ocean economy, which is what's made this really pretty exciting to start. And my background, specifically, I was leading a group of people at NASA that was more on the humanoid robotics side. And so that's robots that sort of have form and function like people. NASA had some ambition to fly them to the space station for some early testing and proving mm-hmm. ground and then send them on their way. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to go to the Mars, it's going to kind of be a big deal. And yeah. You want to make the best use of your time and maybe have some stuff built before you get there. And so the robots we were considering were, okay, let's send them ahead of the people or the mm-hmm. astronauts, have them maybe pre-build some work sites and some infrastructure, you know, because it's going to take a long time to get to Mars. They're going to be on the surface for a couple of years, really, until the, mm-hmm. I think, until the orbits line up so that it's only a 9-month journey home. Mm-hmm. So those robots needed to be able to work with people alongside them in the same spaces, occupy the same tools. And if you look at the cost of sending something even to low Earth orbit, right? I mean, everybody likes to call the $10,000 per pound to low Earth orbit. I mean, with the inflation been running the way it has been, I'm sure that number is quite different now. But, you know, the moon is like a magnitude more than that. And to Mars is like a magnitude more than that. So if you're going to send some stuff, it better be pretty useful. And you don't want to duplicate tools. Mm-hmm. So in order to build all that, we were thinking about how to control robots in faraway locations with very little information. And we developed essentially this hierarchy and this architecture of robot control that would allow us to sort of fly this semi-autonomous agent around and only communicate to it in a very abstract, high-level way. So if you're going to send some robots to Mars, they better be pretty darn useful when they get there. And we had really studied and thought about the control of those robots because you can't send a lot of data. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking like 45-minute communication delays between Mars and Earth, and you're not going to be teleoperating robots over that bandwidth or that latency. So that informed a lot of our early thinking. But, you know, something funny enough happened along the way is we had a lot of visitors to the lab at NASA. Mm-hmm. And some of them were like, hey, that's really cool tech. You know, this robot guy, he's pretty cool. You know, we have a lot of really incredibly, you know, really incredible and interesting work that we do underwater. With a robot like this, be a big deal. And so the first time you hear that, you don't really pay it much mind. It's, you know, we had tours a lot at NASA and people would come by and they, you know, you didn't think about everything.
Yeah. And don't you, weren't you like, trialing this underwater as well as in the zero G tank, is that also part of the work that was done at NASA before it goes to space?
Yeah, they do use the neutral buoyancy lab at NASA pretty extensively. Mm-hmm. We actually never put Robonaut in the neutral buoyancy lab. We threatened it a lot and thought it might be a good idea, but we actually had other ways. We had we had this really cool flat floor where we would float the robots and see the effects of zero G, at least in a planar capacity. We did a lot of climbing and other types of activities with Robonaut. If you have a hyper redundant robot, you know, something that's like 40 or 50 degrees of freedom, you have to devise control methodologies that make it really simple to operate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, trying to manage all those degrees of freedom is rather tough. The camp sort of falls down in two areas, right? You have enough bandwidth that you can teleoperate the machine. And we did that a lot. In fact, we had lots of folks come to the lab interested in telesurgery for its obvious use case. But as I mentioned previously, if you're going to send it to Mars, you're just going to have to use a mouse to tell it what to do, not exactly joysticks. Mm-hmm. And so when those folks would come through the lab and they'd be interested in that ocean technology that I was talking about, we started investigating, okay, what's the alternative? And it turns out they do a lot of teleoperation style work in the ocean. And the infrastructure to enable that is extensive. Mm-hmm. And extremely costly. You know, you're talking large boats, miles of umbilical cable, and this ROV, which looks like a big dishwasher or refrigerator.
Right.
And is this hydraulic system that costs, I mean, just an inordinate amount of money. You're talking $100,000 to $200,000 a day to operate this whole spread and stack. And that's where it became really interesting in my mind, because what I started seeing is, if we could just adapt some of these more far-reaching technologies that we had developed in space and mature them for an ocean environment, you know, there's some changes that have to be made, of course, but we might be able to make a significant impact in how people do stuff underwater.
Wow. So very interesting sort of parallels there to the teleoperation elements and of course the mechanics of the system and figuring out now the use cases for applying that in a different world, in this case underwater, right? Mm-hmm. And so talk to us then about, you know, where are some of those sort of low-hanging market opportunities then that you're chasing with this solution that, you know, look like they're going to be a great opportunity for you to take what you've got and now apply that into a package that works for commercial applications underwater? Because I assume you've got, you know, some real customers here lined up for that operation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's first noting what the ocean economy is. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to sort of lump it all into kind of one bucket. And when you're in Houston, it's real easy to over-focus on oil and gas because, you know, it's the energy capital of the world.
Right.
But if you think about the ocean economy writ large, you're talking industries that aren't really top of mind for people, but are exceedingly important. I mean, the internet that you and I are even talking over right now, mm-hmm. is likely routed through an ocean cable. The food that you'll probably, you know, some of the food that you might have this week is likely sourced from the ocean. And some of the goods that you were probably wearing were traveled on a ship through the ocean. It's and likely the electricity that you're going to put in your car, or again, the gas that you're going to fill your tank up with could have come from the ocean. And so it touches nearly every aspect of our life. It's fascinating. And yet to everybody out there, and I'll tell you even so to an investor community that doesn't really have an appreciation for the breadth of the economy, the changes that are happening in it, it's staggering. And frankly, it's created this obsessive mission for us here at Nauticus to apply deep tech and hard tech principles with a extreme use of machine learning and AI to fundamentally alter the entire ocean economy. I mean, that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So applications, right? Our big discriminator is manipulation.
Okay.
You know, that's what we cut our teeth on at NASA. It's what the company was founded on wanting to alter. It is whenever you have crappy data, crappy communication, low bandwidth, latency, you know, stuff that's like space. And frankly, something that's like the ocean to probably a degree of magnitude more, that's where we come in. And there's an enormous amount of those activities underwater. A large portion of what people do underwater is actually interacting with things, whether it's in the seabed or the water column. You know, we use divers for a lot of stuff. We use ROVs for a lot of stuff. The industries are they're so cross-cutting, right? Like I mentioned, oil and gas, but you got offshore renewables that are really starting to exponentiate.
Mm-hmm.
Offshore wind, right? What's that all about? Okay, well, I gotta install this monopile in the seabed. Then I erect this enormous, several megawatt generating turbine that's buried into the seabed. I gotta route cables from it. And I got to take that back to shore. So it's this enormous infrastructure, and it has to be looked after periodically. It has to be inspected and maintained. And there's a lot of work going on around renewables. And heck, you even have offshore tidal, which is, I think, is about 10% of the offshore renewable energy portfolio. And we don't even think about tidal machines. But all these ocean assets, they need this sort of industrial style technology to come out and make sure they're still working right. And I think that's really where we think we're going to make a huge change. Because why? Here, the question I asked was, why do you need a deep water spread, right? That's a boat, an ROV, and an umbilical. Why do you need a deep water spread if you're going to go into a wind farm? I can see it from shore and it's not in deep water. But yet that's really the only thing we have. And it's really expensive, right? Those people that are deployed offshore. And I think it's also worth noting, that's sort of where the company originated in thinking. But as a consequence, the ocean economy is exceptionally broad, like I've mentioned. Our company's ambition is exceptionally broad, just as broad as the ocean economy. Mm-hmm. And I would expect that our portfolio will extend into nearly every dimension of the ocean environment. And so that's what fires us up, right? That's what gets us going. And so that's what we want to come to work every day and kick ass about. And also, you know, I think it's worth noting that these problems are very hard. In fact, I would say that some of these problems are probably, you know, twice or five times as hard as some of the terrestrial counterparts. I mean, think about this. We're building a self-driving car with a humanoid robot on board to work in the ocean, where it's just like one of the hardest environments, one of the hardest industries, one of the most complicated things to conquer.
Yeah, you've got the experience working in space. How do you contrast those two environments? Because space seems like a very hostile environment. To describe maybe the differences there, because we've seen everything, all the amazing devices that NASA has built and deployed on Mars and the rest. Tell us a little bit about how the undersea environments as hostile or more hostile than those environments.
Yeah, and here I think this is going to start part of our discussion about whether it's the amount of investment going into space or the ocean, or if which one's harder to work in, right? I mean, the ocean and space flight have definitely two camps of people.
Yeah.
Space, the final frontier. Well, the ocean, you know, is classified as the final frontier as well. And it's just funny. There's this fun little competition, it seems, between those two industries. Yeah, so space is definitely challenging. And it is, it's not the most pleasant place to work at either, right? Getting to space is pretty complicated, right? You got to expend a serious amount of energy in a short period of time. But I got to be honest, man, once you're there, it's kind of chill. It's the temperature swings are a big deal, and you're dealing with a one atmosphere change in vacuum, right? You got vacuum and your inside of your stuff is pressurized between, you know, 5 if it's a spacesuit, or maybe 11 or 12 of PSI and if it's a spacecraft. So you're kind of dealing with a vacuum difference. But let's be real clear. There's no aliens yet trying to interfere with what you're doing, and there's no space currents that are trying to whisk your device away, and you don't have the weight of the entire Earth trying to crush you,
right?
When you're down. You know, it's obviously space is challenging.
Yeah.
But NASA and others have shown that they've been able to operate in a pretty successful manner. But I think of deep water drilling as just as complicated as landing a person on the moon. It just is, and they do it routinely. And so there's this dichotomy in the ocean world. It's kind of thought of as laggard, and there are some parts of the industry which are, but but there's also exceptionally high tech things happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's pretty exciting about the industry in general. But, you know, so the ocean world, we're dealing with a pot, you know, this pressure difference where, you know, every 100 meters you go down, you're gaining one atmosphere of pressure. And so, you know, if you're 3,000 meters underwater, you're dealing with 300 atmospheres of pressure difference. You know, if you don't have a good appreciation for that, it's a lot. And it can, you know, they say in space, you know, if your spacecraft lost pressure, you know, you have a few seconds, just long enough so that you know your blood's going to boil and you're going to die this horrible death. If you lost pressure in a capsule, you know, in the Marianas Trench, by the time the window pane cracked, you would have no awareness of what happened. Mm. It's crazy, right? It's just an enormously challenging environment. And you know, it's funny when Walsh and Picard went to the Marianas Trench, I think Challenger Deep, they did have one of their windows crack. And I think about when I read that story, what it had been like if you'd have saw one of your windows, I think they had two or three windows for redundancy. Could you imagine what you would have felt like if one of your outside windows had cracked in the Marianas Trench?
It's time to hit the escape button.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. There's not a lot of options at that point.
Well, hey, let's get to the machine here, the robot, the Aquanaut, which I think is a fascinating implementation of all the things that you've just laid out for us in terms of the challenges that this environment presents and the types of applications and the manipulation needs that you believe are important here. So can you describe for us what Aquanaut is? And specifically, of course, I think its unique transformer-like capability, which I think is just an amazing solution to the engineering problem. So describe for us as best you can what Aquanaut is and how it works.
I'd say it's, you touched on it, right? The key differentiator, you know, the aha moment came from looking and surveying the world of underwater robots, mm-hmm. and seeing really the taxonomy of machines was sort of divided into two camps. They were either like torpedoes or they were boxes. And they were trying to solve two different problems. And so they took on two different distinct forms. So if you want to swim around and take a bunch of pictures, take some survey data, you build a really efficient torpedo. You pack it full of survey gear and you go out, you do your thing and you bring the robot back. Or let's say you want to touch something, right? Turn something underwater, cut something, drop something off, right? Just pick up a clam.
Pick it up and look at it, right?
Yeah. Pick it up and look at it, right? And so then you decide, okay, well, I can't use a torpedo to do that. I can't really stop. A torpedo sort of has to maintain its forward motion to keep its stability. And you know, we've also solved that as well, right? We have hovering AAVs now, but there's really no way to interact. So we said, okay, we need to put manipulators on something, or it needs a station keep. Let's put thrusters everywhere. And it just sort of takes on the form of a box. Well, how do we communicate with it? Well, we're going to have to control it with a joystick. All right, well, we can't. There's not sufficient bandwidth with ACOMs to control it with a joystick, so we're going to need a cable. And so now the cable needs to be attached to something. It's attached to a boat. Just two distinct areas, right? You got your AUVs, your autonomous underwater vehicles that swim and take pictures, or you have your remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, which can interact with stuff. And when we thought about getting into the ocean world, the ocean domain, the ocean economy, I knew or had the very strong feeling that AUVs were starting to feel commoditized. Mm-hmm. I mean, ROVs already were there, right? I mean, if you look at the ROV market and all the top players, they're very undifferentiated. They buy all the same tech. They use all the same kit. There's really no innovation or no technology on any of these things. And the service companies are really competing on price and maybe logistics. AUVs, they started to feel that way. Even though they were more advanced in what they can do, right? Hence the autonomous underwater vehicle part of the AUV. But it's really sort of this energy management, sort of swim in that direction and stop, you know, and then turn at that waypoint when you know where you're at. That's the autonomous part of that.
And for our listeners, so an AUV, very much like a torpedo, but it's an intelligent torpedo with some survey gear. So the equivalency of an air drone with a camera on it that flies around and looks at a bridge.
Yep.
Except you can't really easily stop and hover with it. It has to just sort of keep moving, do its pass, and try to run a grid around whatever you're trying to survey.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, cool, right? Fun problems, great tech. But as I was saying earlier, I decided and I knew we didn't want to be a commodity. We didn't want to have a piece of commoditized hardware like an ROV, and we didn't want a piece. And as the AUVs were becoming more commoditized.
And AUV, the other problem is you hope it comes back, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Because there's no umbilical with
that's
that.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're pretty expensive devices, you know, maybe $6-8 million a piece for some really deep water advanced stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that'd be a bad day if it ended up on the bottom of the seabed and you lost the darn thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how does Aquanaut come about? I literally remember where I was at, where I was sitting, and as I was trying to catalog and create the taxonomy of all the different kinds of ocean vehicles, it sort of hit me and I'm like, why don't people put arms on AUVs? And yes, they can't stop, but there are some AUVs out there that can hover. The big discrimination here is that no one can really communicate with it at a data rate to do anything useful with the AUVs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of just had this aha moment that said, what if we combine the morphology of an AUV and an ROV with the spaceflight technology that we had at NASA that allowed us to communicate with our remote vehicles and get them to interact with the environment in a useful way? Okay, what's the difference? Well, one was an RF medium. Ocean's going to need to be acoustic. But the protocol, right, this delay-tolerant networking protocol that overlays the physical medium, that was the big, you know, how do we do networking underwater in a way that increases quality of service over the singular point-to-point methodologies that they had in ACOMS?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. And so that's been everything. And so now this has afforded us this hybrid vehicle, something that doesn't necessarily need to be tethered to interact with the world around it and can do it in a very robust way. I come to work every day because the problems of the subsea world are so hard.
Yeah.
I mean, think about if you're trying to build a self-driving car algorithm. You know, let's say I'm a startup company and I want to cut my teeth on doing some autonomous driving. I think I've got the coolest next, you know, neuro fuzzy fractal chaotic genetic atomic algorithm that I'm going to deploy. And so I start off and I need to collect some images because I want to create a self-driving car algorithm that avoids hitting cats, right? Well, you can scour the internet for millions of images of contextually labeled cats.
Right.
That tell you exactly what's going on in the image. Here's Fluffy, you know, sitting here on the couch, getting ready to play. I mean, people are hilarious how they label their images online. And so it wouldn't be hard to aggregate all that data, train on it, and start to identify cats and then create an algorithm to avoid cats. We don't have the same benefit underwater, right? I don't have millions of stored images underwater of things that I'm really interested in interacting with that I can train on, especially as they change over time, because marine growth is a big deal. And
so you're talking like the footing of an oil rig.
Oh, whatever. Right. I mean, a valve, a gauge, anything, right. I mean, it's not like I got a billion iPhones underwater taking pictures of oil rigs.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm just saying there's a pretty limited catalog of stuff I can use underwater to train these algorithms that are exceptionally sophisticated, right? These robust algorithms that are able to do things on their own, right? That need that sort of training from the perception data. So there's some really great and interesting work in meta learning and zero shot learning about how you do that on the fly. And we're deploying some of the latest and greatest in those machine learning technologies. And that's what I love, right? And so yeah, everybody focuses on the big orange robot at this company, but at our core, we're a software company. We're an AI company. We're, you know, using some of the most advanced stuff. I mean, the compression algorithms that we're using to send data back and forth in the ocean world. I mean, this is some cutting edge shit. You know, And you know, we don't get enough credit from the investor community for this. And this is actually maybe one criticism and something I'll talk about in the investment community. But, you know, we're an industrial technology company, and which I love. You know, I'm sort of have this old soul. You know, I love to think about aviation when it started in the, you know, in the 20s and 30s when it was starting to go commercial and get off the ground. And we used to build stuff, right? I mean, it's like the venture capital community was born out of like a post-World War II era where we built stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just awesome, right? You know, your Howard Hughes's and your titans of industry that built stuff. And now it's all about, you know, does it scroll or does it swipe? And can I walk my dog with it? And, you know, can I get food on it? And I mean, I get all that, but there's only so many dog walking apps the world can write. You know, this is a physical world and we're going to have to interact with it in a physical way. And it's really unfortunate that the investment community doesn't view industrial tech as needing or as valuable as a, you know, as a photo app. And I mean, if you look at like, you know, the world, the US deploys about, call it $175, $200 billion of venture capital money every year. 60% of that goes to software only companies.
Yep.
Software only. And I've had my share of investors that are like, oh, you guys have hard, oh, we're not interested. Okay. You're not interested in something that has 70% margins. Cool. Got it. You know, so the 60% are software companies. The other, there's 32% of that 200 billion or so, which are deployed to consumer facing, financial technologies, healthcare, you know, things in that world. 8% of VC money deployed in the US went to industrial hard tech, deep tech style technology company.
Yep.
And how much of that 8% do you think went to the ocean world? Right? not very much. I can assure you of that. So it's just crazy to me, like the de-emphasis that the investment community has placed on hardware style companies that I think have an opportunity to make some of the biggest change and become some of the most valuable. You know, that's the thing about hardware. It's hard. And when you get it right, you naturally have this exceptional moat around you, which is hard to duplicate. As opposed to a software company where every person who gets an idea in a laptop can bang out something and put a .com on it and think they've started a company. But man, I wish we could get back to just innovating in the industrial world, because that's the magic, man. That's where the magic happens.
Well, I really want to come back to, you know, the designs that you guys have innovated here and why this is novel. And I want to touch back on the question in my mind that Aquanaut functions without a tether. Mm-hmm. I think you've stated that. So you can give it a mission. It can go down and operate, manipulate things, really. I mean, do you talk about, you know, at what point are you checking in with the device? What can you see live video? Can you change the operation of what it's seeing as you encounter things that you didn't anticipate to help it? But it's got some level of autonomy. Yeah. In it as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it has a very high degree of self-sufficient behaviors. One of the biggest, I'd say, things you'll notice straight away is it doesn't look like a normal ROV.
Yeah.
I'd say one of the greatest compliments the company's ever received on LinkedIn was we posted a picture of Aquanaut and somebody had commented, this was like really early on, they'd said that thing looks like it had just dropped out of Pixar. And I was like, that's exactly what we were going for.
Yeah.
Not necessarily Pixar, but something that signaled this is new and novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not want to create a box. Not only did a box not make sense for us because we wanted to be able to swim far and manipulate. So if you got to swim far, it needs to be hydrodynamically efficient, it needs to be able to go somewhere for 100 kilometers. So you need to look like a torpedo. But when you get to where you're going, a torpedo is a really bad thing to have manipulate something. So you had to deploy additional thrusters. You wanted to create a bit more stability in the buoyancy, you know, where the center of mass and the center of buoyancy were located to each other. So we had to raise the hull to create a much more stable manipulation platform. And therefore, we'd have to be able to manipulate with, and to do that, you have to deploy manipulators, which are stored in the vehicle. Something else that's quite interesting is it's fully electric. I'd say 95 to 99% of ROVs in the world are hydraulic.
Oh.
hydraulics need fluids, fluids need circulation, pump. You know, sometimes that fluid circulates back to the ship. Sometimes that fluid circulates locally on the ROV. If you don't have a tether, you can't use those methodologies. And even if it's circulated locally in the vehicle, the pump would just eat up your battery because pumps are really crappy. So we were like, we need to make a fully electric hybrid AUV ROV transformer superhero. And, you know, that's kind of what we did.
So did you have to solve some problems with electric motors and elbows and graspers under the water?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, there's not a catalog of electric arms and electric actuation out there. So we had to invent it all. And, you know, we have a patent on Aquanaut, its morphology, its function. We have a patent on the electric manipulation. Patent pending. That there wasn't an available store of cool tech we could just pull off and slap stuff together. And we really did, you know, similar to space, everything has to be fully electric in space. You know, I remember one of these first design reviews. So one of our early investors, Schlumberger, incredible technology company, they wanted us, they saw what we were doing with actuation, the electric actuation, the arms we were building with Aquanaut. And they had said, hey, can you apply that to this other thing that we have over here? It's deep sea. We use hydraulics to actuate this particular effect, and we want to transition to electrics-based actuation. So they gave us a design challenge. They said, we've already tried this, but we don't want you to see what our solution looks like. We want to see what you guys come up with. And so we, you know, based a lot of this stuff on what we were doing from Aquanaut, which was based on a lot of the stuff we were doing at NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember our first design review. We were like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And we show it up there on the screen. And they're like, wait, we don't understand. We're like, no, it's just like this. And they said, well, that's half the size of what we came up with. We're like, okay, well, what did you guys do? And they're like, well, here's our gear set. Here's this, here's that. And they're like, what did you guys do? And we're like, well, here's our main actuator. Here's our main gear. And they're like, what's that thing in the middle? And I was like, that's called a harmonic drive. And they were like, what's that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I actually had just come from a trade show and I had a plastic little harmonic drive in my bag and I pulled it out and they stared at it. I remember this designer stared at this thing like it was alien technology that had dropped out of the plant, you know, out of the stars. And they're like, what is that? Right. And so it's just, we didn't realize, but we were just operating on a different plane with some of the stuff we were doing, because here's the biggest foundational difference that I think will weather vane our success is that in this industry, we're competing with a bunch of companies that are now trying to become robotics experts.
Yeah.
We hired and have formed a company around robotics experts, and now we're hiring all the offshore expertise in. It just came from a different direction.
Interesting.
When you get to the core of Aquanaut, it is full of some of the latest NASA tech you could possibly think of, which has now been hardened with some of the best partnerships in this ocean industry you could possibly pull together. Aquanaut will be the most advanced robot in the ocean, bar none, and we're building a fleet of them. We're just so damn fired up every day to be working on this. You know, everybody's like, oh, do you have problem recruiting in Houston? I'm like, no, we usually have 100 times more resumes than we have positions. They're like, how do you get someone to move to Houston? I'm like, what's wrong with Houston? They're like, well, you know, it's XYZ, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, no, it's actually a pretty cool town. And no, we don't never had any trouble recruiting people to Houston. And that's part of my mission in here, honestly, is to help shine a light on Houston as a city by building one of the most advanced and I'd say technologically competent, you know, smaller stage companies, early stage companies in this area and for this economy. You know, that's, we think about that every day we're here at Nauticus. That's part of also what we're trying to do.
Interesting. So there's one last technical area that I wanted to ask you about relative to Aquanaut. And so it's this lack of the umbilical, and you talk about the communication underwater. What can you tell us about, you know, what novel ways you've used to solve that? Talk to us about, you know, can you get live video out of this? And you know, what does that look like? What are there any delays or what, how close to real-time control do you get out of actual manipulation, depending on how far the vehicle is from the surface?
Yep. So there's been a lot of advancements in acoustic communication technologies.
When you say acoustic, describe what that means.
So acoustic modems, you know, think dial-up networking circa 1989.
The old AOL.
Oh yeah. You know, I still have my 25,000 hours of AOL on my CD, you know, my desk that we, you know, we've been able to scour that for how we do underwater stuff. I'm kidding. But
yeah.
So data rates are very similar. You're talking in the tens of Ks and the best, you know, you can get up to 100K of data rate underwater.
Okay.
You know, maybe 3000 meter vertical channel, something like that, but you can still do a lot of work with something that operates between 50 and 100K, you know, kilobits per second of data transfer. Now that's kind of the world of acoustic modems, and that's on the super high end side. Most of them are like 5 kilobits per second.
Mm-hmm.
People are usually talking about, you know, how many, you know, bits per minute, let alone bits per second sometimes with acoustic comms. But there's two dimensions to the technology, right? There's the protocol in which you bit bang the bit banger, and then there's the bit banging itself. Mm-hmm. And we partnered with Schlumberger on the bit banging part, and they developed a very special and fantastic acoustic modem, which I'll call the physical layer, right? The thing, how it's transmitted. And we've licensed that from them. And the data rates are exceptional. You can get live video. It is delayed. It is delayed because the speed of sound through water is 1500 meters per second.
Right.
Yep. So, you know, if for every mile you're communicating over, you're basically dealing with a second of latency.
Okay.
So then you're dealing with a round trip. And so you can, even in a vertical channel, you can deal with 4 to 5 seconds of latency. So you are getting video, but it's 5 seconds ago video.
Okay.
Which necessitates the other part of Aquanaut, which is so badass. You know, it's super smart. It's very robust. It can handle a lot of activity on its own. But going back to your technology question around acoustics. So that's sort of the first part, right? The bit banger. The second part is the protocol in which that's happening over. Now, most people in the underwater world use a point-to-point communication methodology, like NEMA strings that are sent over, which is exceptionally limiting. You just, the way it's handshaked, the way the packets are transmitted and received. And it's like, there's so many hops back and forth just to verify something got sent through, because the quality of service sucks. And so, did I actually send this? Let me verify it. Okay. You know, 10 seconds later, you figure out your actually packet went through, and you're not going to do any direct teleoperation over data rates like that. Right. So what we also discovered is that the way we operate in deep space, because we have similar challenges, right? And there's a style of networking called delay or disruptive tolerant networking, because there's a lot of stuff underwater that disrupt.
Right. Yeah. I was going to ask, I mean, the thermal climate can affect that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is absolutely. The water temperature changed, right? Can create, and is there
absolutely. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Is there a limitation to how far this works, or, you know, in terms of the distance that you can be, and is it direction? The other thing about outer space, a satellite has to push its antenna back to Earth, right? And if it's off, that signal goes away, never gets to Earth. Same thing here. You have to have sort of a directional antenna back to the ship.
Yeah, there's directional components to it. There's also omnidirectional, but at lower data rates.
Yeah, okay.
So there's things that interfere with it, right? So since we're dealing with sound, there's a lot of stuff in the ocean that makes sound. In fact, one of the most disruptive little boogers underwater that screw up acoustic communications are snapping shrimp. Turns out they sort of click in the same frequency the modems operate in, and it kind of creates some noise. But, you know, you don't have to deal with snapping shrimp in space. I can assure you of that. You know, there's other things like solar radiation that screws up communications. But yeah, it's exceptionally, really hard problem, man. Really hard problem that has taken a long time to figure out, which I think really cements a good competitive advantage for us.
So Nick, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is relative to how you're commercializing this solution. And as I understand it, you offer the use of the robot as a service. And I've seen a variety of ways that folks have configured, you know, their services here. And I think this is a unique proposition. So if you can you talk to us about how you sell the solution or the service and what it is that a customer is buying from you and how that whole thing rolls out.
Yeah, it became pretty evident early on to me that I saw a lot of failed robotics companies over my years, especially when I was in the government. And it seemed to be characterized and highlighted in one particular way, which is people don't want robots. They don't want to buy them. You know, the quickest way to go out of business as a robotics company is to sell robots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you saw this trend, which is, okay, people don't want the robot. They don't want to buy the robot. They just want what they do. All right, let's sell what they do. And even from a business model, it's much better because instead of realizing a one-time margin, you know, even if that margin is 100%, being able to use a robot for its 8-year depreciable life, and then, you know, your ROI on our initial investment is many times that, frankly. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how we got into that. It was, and these robots and these machines are sufficiently advanced that owning and operating them and then selling the service gives us a fairly distinct competitive advantage because the service we can offer out at is probably about 75% less than the market rate. Hmm. And that's because it's a robot and it's because it's jam-packed full of our technologies. And so it was just hand in glove on how that all came together. You know, I wouldn't say it's out of necessity, but frankly, another sort of angle that I think I became quickly aware of pretty early on as well, is that I would, you know, in Nauticus's early history, you know, we got invited to inspection conferences and you would see all the robots.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be these companies selling robots and to inspection service companies. And the next year you'd go to the conference and the inspection service company is still there with their little booth and the inspection robot, but the company that was selling the inspection robot's out of business. And, you know, it sort of just hinted at, you know, there's sort of you can saturate the market of people wanting to acquire those robots really quickly. But the service always seems to persist.
Mm.
So, you know, just combined all of that. And we knew that trying to not sell all the market leaders, you know, whether it be, you know, Oceaneering or Technip or Saipem or, you know, any of the big players all the way down to, you know, the ma and pa shops, selling them a piece of our advanced technology, even if they bought it. Let's say that, you know, we nailed it, they loved it and they bought it. Well, they buy a certain inventory of it, then they wouldn't talk to you for 7 years because if it worked really well, they wouldn't need to.
One of the things I've observed with a lot of these companies, that robot companies that are selling their solutions as a service, is that customer intimacy, right? The ability to actually understand how the customer is using it every day. So if whether it was a warehouse robot or an assembly robot, right, they could see the frequency at which it's being used, see where it's failing, those type of things. Does that not also apply to your design here as well, that as you deploy it, as you use it, you learn new ways where to prioritize your roadmap, and it's just a much shorter iteration cycle for you to optimize around, you know, what it is that's important to your customer.
That's exactly right. In fact, you know, I would characterize some of the successes that companies have is this intimate understanding about exactly where their piece of kit is going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to obtain, right? And so the best way to be a believer is use your own stuff.
Yeah.
And the, you know, cause everything has to be iterated and you sort of like, you know, you spiral in on a capability, right? Well, it's, you know, try this, come back, try that. But if you're getting that feedback from somebody you sold the system to, it might come every 6 months, right? Because they're not going to talk to you that frequently. They're going to try to figure it out. They're going to try to duct tape something together. They're going to have all the inside information on how it's actually being used. They're going to be frustrated that it doesn't do this. You know, they might voice something to you. Then you're in a long, lengthy development cycle. But if you have it in your possession, you can see it in real time, make those adjustments, refine the capability, and have a higher service offering. So it just makes a ton of sense all around.
Right. And you described this is still a frontier. So the types of applications that you're put in, maybe it's the first time something's been automated for that.
No, so, that's exactly right.
So you're learning off that, learning whether something's going to have the potential to be successful or whether it's a quick pivot to something else that's, you know, adjacent to what you're doing, right?
Well, the other thing is you also control your own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
I was advised in certain areas on some industrial automation. Let's say, you know, I'll give an analog because I don't want to give away the company. If I named this, everyone would know it. But let's say you're trying to automate some machinery in the field and it's currently operated by people, but the people have to sort of hang out with you in the interim while it's being tested.
Mm-hmm.
9 times out of 10, it doesn't matter how good it operates. If the person that whose job you're replacing is involved in the testing of it, it's never going to go well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they always have a way of sabotaging the testing so that the automation or the robot autonomy doesn't quite work the way as advertised. And so if you control your own destiny, meaning, you know, if you operate your own equipment, you're always assured that there's nothing malicious happening. You know,
right.
You know, if somebody bought your kit and, you know, let's say, you know, a large service, offshore service company was trying to completely tear down and corporately disrupt how they do business. Well, there's going to be an internal incumbency and a bias that mm-hmm. probably doesn't want it to change either. Right. And so
right.
Yep. It's amazing how those things never, or they're always self-fulfilling prophecies of not working if you're trying to tear down what 75% of the company does.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I've seen it many times in my career as a product manager. And even,
I mean, that's why corporate disruption is so difficult for large Fortune 500 companies, because to adequately disrupt the corporation, you're telling, you know, a large majority of probably what's going on that you need to change. And if you need to change, that's scary. Who knows what's coming next? Do I still have a job?
Mm-hmm.
And those things struggle to get off of top dead center because there's a lot of antibodies that can develop very quickly with you know, interesting bedfellow incentive structures.
So just to sort of tie this up, this question, as I understand it, I mean, you have the actual robot, the underwater device that does its job, but there's a whole lot that goes on at the surface here. And when you talk about having the boat that actually takes you out to the site and all of the folks on board the boat, it's more than just the deployment of the robot that you're selling here. You got to make sure that pays for all that other infrastructure, right? So it's a sort of an all in to actually, if you're going to go out and you're going to inspect or you're going to install something or you're going to, whatever you're going to do, it has to cover all those sort of fixed costs that are maybe not obvious at first glance, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know, our entire offering includes a small surface vessel as well. You know, batteries still suck. You know, there's no way of getting around it. For our pretty far out deployments, we have a small 18-meter autonomous surface vessel called Hydronaut that is optionally crewed, and we envision it being crewed for about the next 2 years with about 4 people. And so that little 18-meter vessel drops off Aquanaut, which is now the tetherless subsea asset that does all the cool work underwater. The pair of those cost about $7 million to make, and we make $8 million a year on the pair.
So that Hydronaut can actually be deployed for near shore from the pier, for example, and it would need the larger surface ship as you might need in the deep sea if you're farther offshore.
Yeah, so Hydronaut is the autonomous surface vessel.
Yeah.
You know, it is deployed out of small marinas and whatnot.
Aquanaut
could be shore deployed. You know, it makes a lot of sense for wind farms. They're only a few kilometers offshore. It's not like you got to travel 100 miles or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sorry for switching units.
Yeah.
We just crashed another spacecraft. Apologize.
Well, hey, so one more question then before I let you go today, and it's sort of related to, I was in preparing for the interview, I saw that you recently signed another government contract, and we've talked to a variety of companies as well that have used government contracts to help fund the early days while developing the solution and nurturing the market. So tell us a little bit about your philosophy there, what this contract specifically means for, you know, your future and how it helps you get to where you want to go.
You know, the way we leverage government investment, it was purposeful in our go-to-market strategy. Government is an early adopter, oftentimes, of technology. And even more so, they're kind of like, hey, that didn't quite work right. Here's some more money. Try it again. In the commercial world, you know, you can get blacklisted pretty fast for showing up with stuff that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And you only get a couple bites at the apple, right? The government, pretty patient. They tend to have a longer horizon on what their interests are. Mm-hmm. Their problems tend to be a lot harder, though, and they're a little bit more R&D centric, which also plays really well into subsidizing your own internal R&D. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, doing business with the government is a useful tool. It should factor into a lot of people's portfolio. You know, I didn't want to be a contractor to the government again. And of course, you know, I had the privilege to be at NASA, but I also worked with a lot of government agencies in defense and intel, frankly. And so it was a really fun career. But at the end of the day, if I was going to start a business, go through that pain, I wanted to feel like there was some upside potential to it. Mm-hmm. And being a government contractor is just kind of limited, you know?
Yeah.
And by design, I mean, people shouldn't be just getting stupid rich off of working with the government. The commercial sector is, I think, can reward people when you get it right. So to fully answer your question, I think the government is an interesting place to help develop new tech. They've got very favorable IP rights where you own what you develop. Mm-hmm. You know, if war breaks out with North Korea, then the government sort of has the ability to, you know, give your stuff to Boeing and say, build 1,000 of these. But if Boeing's building 1,000 of something because we just have war with North Korea, I'm not really worried about my IP issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we've been really successful in developing technology with government interests and putting it into commercial practice. So I love it. It's been very helpful. Now, there are some negatives. There are absolutely some negatives. Accounting is notoriously difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, if you work in the defense world, hiring U.S. only persons, that can be rather limiting. You know, there's a bureaucracy that's imposed on you when you do government contracts. And sometimes that bureaucracy can get in the way of your commercial efforts. And so when you have dual use technology like we do, you have to be really careful not to let the government imposed bureaucracy really impede commercial progress, because the commercial world moves at the speed of business. Mm-hmm. The government interests move, well, frankly, whenever the hell they want to.
And so there's a little bit of additional overhead is what you're saying, if you're going to go this route beyond just being a startup.
No, I wouldn't call it little. I'd call it a significant additional overhead.
Okay. Fair enough. From one who's been in the trenches with it. So I appreciate that view. So, well, I want to thank you, Nick, for joining us on the show today. I appreciate the conversation. It's been very exciting. I look forward to following your progress and your next innovation here. You guys keep throwing out some great videos. So it's really
cool
to watch this underwater and what you're doing. So I wish you all the best.
Mike, loved it. Sincerely appreciate getting to spend some time with you, and happy to give you an update in the future.
Great. So Nick Radford, founder and CEO of Nauticus Robotics. You can learn more about them on the web at nauticusrobotics.com. That's Nauticus Robotics, all one word, .com. And go check them out.
Once again, thanks to Nick Radford, founder and CEO of Nauticus Robotics, for joining the show. I know he's a busy guy, a lot of milestones that they're also reaching. So thanks so much, Nick, for taking the time there. Mike, any final takeaways from you?
Well, this was a fun interview. Nick's a passionate leader. And as he talked, I learned a lot about what he calls the ocean economy, which is clearly a nascent market right now for robotics and automation. Still a lot of manual things done as he would teleoperated ROVs, of course. So there are solutions, but they're all teleoperated. And as we learned, you know, not that the Aquanaut is fully untethered, and I found it fascinating the way that they're actually operating with that. So I look forward to watching them evolve and this market as a whole. So I've always loved the ocean, and it's going to be fun to see what they can continue to do as this iterates and grows.
Yeah, I'm bummed that I missed that interview. I had a sick kid and still have a sick kid, so I wasn't able to be there earlier this week. But he's a fascinating dude. We had him speak in one of our Robo Business Direct webinars that we did a couple of years ago during the height of the pandemic. And just a fascinating guy, just all around, space robots to ocean economy, right? Just two of the untapped areas of the world. And he's doing a great job of trying to open up those areas and help us learn more about those areas. So thanks again to Nick for taking the time to do that. Before we go, folks, we do have to tell you about a few different things going on. Robotics Summit call for speakers still ongoing. Robotics Summit is co-located with the Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum, May 10th and 11th, 2023 in Boston. These are design and development events for commercial robotics systems. So we're looking for experts like yourselves to come enlighten us and teach and educate everybody at the show about enabling technologies or manufacturing techniques or design techniques that will help improve the next generation of commercial robots. So again, we're looking for speakers for both those shows, Robotics Summit, Healthcare Robotics Engineering Forum. If you go to roboticssummit.com, you'll be able to throw your ideas in there and be considered to talk at the show. Again, May 10th, 11th, 2023 in Boston. We're going to have 140, 150 exhibitors at the show. A couple cool, very cool keynotes, Mike. I think we should just let them out of the bag. Confirmed for this show already. We'll be doing a fireside chat with Mark Raybert, founder of Boston Dynamics. He's also leading the new Boston Dynamics AI Institute. So we'll be chatting with Mark, you know, just about his career, what he's done at Boston Dynamics, and what are some of the challenges that they're trying to solve going forward at the Boston Dynamics AI Institute. Athletic AI is one of them. So really interesting discussion with Mark will take place. We've also got the CTO of Motional, Laura Major. She'll be discussing some of the work that Motional is doing to develop robo-taxis. They have a number of services up and running in around Las Vegas. They just announced they're expanding soon to Los Angeles. So we're really looking forward to the show. We'll have 2,500 plus people there. So if you want to get involved, head over to roboticssummit.com. And finally, RBR 50 entries will be opening next week at some point. The RBR 50 Robotics Innovation Awards. This is our annual awards program, recognizing some of the more innovative robotics systems and robotics enabling technologies that are out there. So if you're a company who develops an enabling technology or a full-blown robotic system that you think is pretty innovative and was introduced within the last year, you should be involved in this program. Again, a lot of people have been asking us about this, so be on the lookout for that opening up sometime next week. That's going to do it, folks. Episode 100 of the Robot Report podcast. Thank you again, seriously, folks, for all the support from all the sponsors, from all the speakers, but most importantly, from all you folks who are tuning into the show. This wouldn't be possible without you. We wouldn't be doing this if people weren't listening. If you haven't subscribed, please do that. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms. Leave us a rating, give us a review, tell your friends about us. That's going to help grow this podcast and get it in front of more people. And be on the lookout Friday or Thursday for our playlist of our favorite episodes from the first 100. And again, if you have any comments about your favorite episodes, your favorite guests, things that you would like to see Mike and I do better, do differently, we're an open book. So please reach out. We're here for you guys to try to help you guys educate yourselves and learn about the industry. So any comments that you guys have for us would be greatly appreciated. On behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again soon.